All right. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Morello. I'm an architect at Microsoft. I work in Microsoft Services, and this is a session AAP 315 about Microsoft Data Center Services. This is an architect-focused session, as the title implies here, so it's probably going to be a little bit different than a lot of the product and technology-specific sessions that you've been to. Not to say it's not technical at all, but it's definitely a lot less product-specific and much more solution-specific, I guess you'd say. And I think that'll be clear to you as we go through it, but basically what you could expect out of this session is a lot less talk about, you know, here are the features of VMM and Windows Server, Hyper-V, and so forth, and more about how all those pieces come together to help deliver various sorts of private and hybrid and flexible cloud solutions for customers. So just kind of give you that disclaimer up front, that way if anybody was expecting something that's, you know, super technical, there's plenty of great sessions on that. You guys can feel free to go to one of those if you'd like. It won't offend me. I just want to make sure everybody's expectations are properly set. Before I get started, let me give you a little bit of background on myself. I've been at Microsoft for about 12 years. For the first 5 years or 6 years or so, I was in services as a consultant. Then I spent the last 5 years in the product team. So I worked on direct access and certificate services, so our PKI stack, basically from Windows Server 2008 all the way through Windows Server 8 or Server 2012 as it's now called. And last year in the fall, I went back to services to run the private cloud practice for the Americas. So I run a team of consultants around the Americas who build our next generation data centers for a lot of our enterprise customers. In fact, many of the public wins that you guys have seen referenced, like at the launch event, customers like very well-known retailers, one of our case studies, one of the world's largest airlines. T. Rowe Price was one of the customers that was actually used by name at the launch event. So, you know, if you're ever shopping or buying gas or flying on a major airline, there's a good chance that you're touching some of the systems that my team has built. So what we're going to really talk about today is what we've learned through that and the sort of skills and experiences that we can bring to bear from a services standpoint that can make it easier and faster and safer for you guys as customers to get the value that you want to get out of the private cloud. So again, it's not so much about talking about product-specific features as it is how do we take all the experiences that we've had working with lots of other customers and actually make them relevant and real and usable in your own organization. Kind of the joke I always like to make with customers when we talk about this is really the core value that we provide to you as a customer is that you get to learn from everybody else's mistakes, right? By working with us, by working with in any Microsoft partner for that matter, you get to build not only on their own particular unique body of experiences that they have as individuals, but also in all the experiences they've collected over time. And so the end result of that is that you have better designs that are faster to implement, cheaper to operate, and hopefully provide you a higher quality of service over time. So we'll talk a lot more about how that's actually delivered, but I just want to give you some kind of level set on what to get out of this session. So we basically have these five agenda topics we'll get through. Again, this is an architect-focused session, so we'll probably have a little bit of a, I don't want to say an academic discussion, but really a discussion about what really is private cloud to start with. I like to lead in with that because, like any other term that's very popular and gets co-opted by marketing, every vendor out there, Microsoft included, has kind of abused the term cloud and shaped it and twisted it into whatever, you know, helps them sell product at any given point in time, right? I mean, it's kind of everybody's thing. You know, if you had something that used to be called an application service provider, suddenly now they're a cloud provider. If you had traditional outsourcing, now they're a cloud provider. If you had an application that ran on a web server and was delivered through a browser, well, now it's a cloud application, right? But there's actually some things that are unique and that really are specific about the cloud. And NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which defines a lot of other standards that you're all familiar with, for example, you know, like you know, big contributor to the definition of the metric system, for example. So very well-known standards. They've actually articulated what I think is a really good definition about what private cloud and cloud in general is. And I think it's really useful to understand that because as you go and talk and think about this in your own organizations and how this could map to the sorts of capabilities that you want to have in your own companies, understanding what that definition is and what the different variants of that are is a really good way to have a common standard set of vocabulary that you can use that's specific and targeted at what you're trying to achieve and not really just a marketing buzzword that you kind of repeat over and over. So we'll go through that discussion first. We'll look at our data center services offering. Data center services is a set of intellectual property that Microsoft Services has built and continues to build and maintain that makes it easier for a customer to be able to deploy a private or hybrid cloud. So that includes all the product stuff that you guys are already well familiar with, you know, System Center and Hyper-V and PowerShell and all the great stuff that goes along with that, but wraps it all into an offering that makes it faster and easier and, again, safer for you to be able to deploy it. So we'll look at what that looks like. We'll drop into a little bit of a technology slant then for a little while and look at some actual user interfaces and user experiences from DCS so you can get a feel for what it looks like both as a self-service user, as an administrator. Then we'll talk about some features that we have in DCS that I think are really relevant at this point in time when we talk about private cloud, and those things are called hydration and migration. Hydration is basically a way for us to deploy in a very low cost and repeatable way very complex workloads onto a private cloud. So let's say you wanted to deploy a very large-scale SharePoint farm. Rather than you actually having to build the infrastructure and click through all the UIs to install SharePoint, part of the intellectual property that we deliver is this hydration mentality where the entire thing is scripted, the entire build process is automated, and thus very repeatable and very low cost to do. So we'll look at how that works and how that helps you as a customer. And then migration, obviously, is about getting off of VMware and onto the Microsoft private cloud stack. And then finally, we'll wrap things up and take a little quick look at a case study with one of our customers that we worked with building a private cloud. And in their case, actually a hybrid cloud that integrates with Office 365. We have a relatively small number of people in this session, so I'd be more than happy to take questions as we go along. If you do have any questions, please feel free to raise your hand, and assuming that we don't disrupt the general cadence and flow of the session too much, I'll just take them as they come up. So let's talk about what private cloud actually is. I mentioned earlier the NIST cloud definition framework. This is something that's publicly available if you go to nist.gov. They've got a very detailed white paper that you can read, and as well as many of these diagrams here. But again, one thing that I've found, one of the big parts of my job is going to our customers and helping them think through what do they want to evolve their data centers into. You know, there's all these new capabilities that are coming online today, both from a software as a service standpoint, like with Office 365, where customers are saying, you know, why do I need to even run Exchange myself anymore or run SharePoint myself anymore, to infrastructure as a service. That's your Rackspace and Amazon Web Services, and now what we're launching this week with Azure and virtual machines. Some really powerful capabilities there that make people say, you know, is the whole notion of me having a data center and running applications myself, is that an antiquated thing? Is that a business that I should even be in anymore? And the answer to that, like any other complex question, usually ends up being it depends. And there's a lot of variables that go into that, and we'll talk about what some of those are. But what this definition really helps you do is to think about what are the different models that are there, what are the attributes that define those models, and then to have a better conversation using a very clear vocabulary about what those goals and characteristics are so that we're not talking about one particular vendor's idea of what the cloud is, but we're really talking about what is a common cross-platform heterogeneous way of looking at all these capabilities and then designing a system that works best for you and your unique needs at your customer. So some of the common characteristics, these are things that are basically part of any cloud definition that you might come across. Obviously, massive scale or internet scale. You're going to be able to run not just hundreds or thousands of servers, but tens of thousands of virtual machines and servers. The geographic distribution, you know, you wouldn't really consider something to be a cloud if it only operated in a single data center that, you know, if there was a tornado, then the entire service was offline. The idea of having virtualization, either at the hypervisor level or at some other level of abstraction. For example, what you get with Azure and platform as a service, while there is a hypervisor that's involved in it, the real layer of abstraction that you care about is between the application that you're running and the underlying OS, right? So virtualization and abstraction are probably two common terms there. So again, these are terms that pretty much any vendor would say probably agree are parts of what a cloud service would look like. But NIST goes a step further and says there is these five things that are truly essential characteristics of a cloud, and that if you have four out of five of them, while you're 80% of the way there, you really don't have truly a cloud. You've got something that's approaching a cloud or is cloud-like or has a lot of characteristics of it, but really isn't something that we would traditionally consider to be a cloud. So let's talk about each one of them so that we can, again, be very specific about what they mean. So at the bottom level, working our way up, resource pooling is the idea of not having to assign a given tenant or a given application to a specific piece of hardware or a particular virtual machine. So if you think about how, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, you would provision IT capacity, you would probably, if there was a business group that came to you and said, I want to deploy a new line of business application, You probably would purchase a new server for them. You'd install an operating system on that. You'd install their application on that, and that was their kind of discrete unit of capacity. The idea of resource pooling is to get away from that, right, and to focus on how do you deliver the application while taking advantage of a large set of resources that are just kind of randomly assigned to that application or that service at any given point in time. So if you're running a virtual machine on Windows Azure today, you don't know what specific server it operates on. You don't care what server it operates on. Similar to if you're accessing a mailbox on Office 365 or on Google Apps or if you're accessing some data on Salesforce.com, you don't care where that data actually lives. I mean, it's part of that overall resource pool. The service is what really matters to you. Broad network access is the idea of not being reliant upon VPNs and kind of that whole concept of deperimerization. In other words, again, going back to that model from maybe a decade ago, if you want to provide access to that app, people had to be locally attached to your network through some, physically plugged in maybe through VPN or whatever. But the idea with broad network access here is that essentially anywhere you are, as long as you have an internet connection, you should be able to easily utilize that application. So typically that means it's being delivered over some sort of secure transport layer connectivity, such as SSL or maybe an IPsec solution or something like that. Rapid elasticity means that you can deploy new capability in that application, new capacity, the ability to host new users or larger amounts of data, more or less on demand. You don't have to go back and rebuild the entire application. You don't have to rethink the way that it's designed. You simply say that for this big data store, this Hadoop store that you want to be able to crunch some numbers in, you're just going to add new units of CPU or new units of storage or networking or what have you to facilitate the greater levels of performance or scale that you're looking for. So elasticity is the idea of not being bound, again, to that single discrete unit, but instead focusing on the resource pool and being able to expand or contract that pool dynamically as needed. Measured service is the idea of saying, well, given all of that capability that's out there, instead of consuming that service as simply saying, I have this server, I bought this server, I bought a license for this application, and it's going to run for X number of years, and I'll deprecate those costs over that time period, you're now able to say, I want to pay for that application, or I want to pay for that functionality on kind of a pay-per-use basis. It may be charged by CPU hour. It may be charged per user, per month, per mailbox in Office 365. It may be something based on the number of customer records that you maintain in Dynamics CRM or something like that. But basically, the idea here is that there's a way to measure your consumption of the service and potentially to charge you based on that consumption. So one of the things we often hear about from customers is the idea of chargeback and how they'd like to be able to pass costs along to the business. And frankly, that seems at this point, it's a little ambitious. Most customers say that they want to do that, but then when it really comes down to it, oftentimes it's something where the business themselves may not be so ready to be paying per file share or per whatever service it is they happen to be consuming. So instead, what we found as a good model is this idea of showback, where if you can just report on that service measurement, the number of cores that your application used as the business unit, or the number of units of database capacity that you provided to run some line of business application, that can start transitioning the conversation with the business unit away from IT simply being some infrastructure operator, but really talking more about how the application is used and how the application can be better tuned to provide maybe better capacity or performance, or just to lower the cost to the business. And then finally, on-demand self-service, the idea of that being that instead of requiring somebody from the IT department to manually go in there and build the server and install the application and create the configuration for it, that instead there's at least a subset of those capabilities that are provided directly to your consumer. That consumer may be the business unit themselves, it may be an end user, but think about just the scenario that you're all probably very familiar with today. If you want to go and sign up for an account with Windows Azure, you go through a completely credit card and Microsoft account-based experience to do that. You don't have to talk to somebody in Windows Azure. You don't actually have to send an email to anybody to do that. And that's really kind of plays into that whole meme of consumerization, right? I mean, if you think about consumerization beyond, just people being able to bring their own device into work and use it for email, but instead kind of that entire experience where, people are very used to and comfortable with the idea of managing their own IT, this is kind of the natural offset of that when we start talking about the cloud world. So those five essential characteristics, again, the way that NIST defines them, these are mandatory things that make up any cloud. And then there's the three service models of that. I'm sure you guys are probably familiar with them, but just to quickly recap on there, software as a service is a fully packaged thing. That's where you're buying Dynamics CRM or Office 365 or Salesforce.com or whatever, where it's not something that you have to go and develop to get to get value out of it, that instead it's a fully built, fully utilizable offering that your end users can immediately start to get value from. Platform as a service is something more like Windows Azure, where what you're building or buying, rather, is a development framework, a hosting environment such that you can build your own application or extend an existing application without having to worry about the underlying infrastructure. So with platform as a service, you say that you're going to give up control of the infrastructure in return for a cheaper development model and an easier way to be able to scale that application. One of the neat things that, you know, that's a very common Azure demo is, you know, you can literally in the space of just 4 or 5 clicks go from building a website that's only available in the United States to having a website that is completely geographically dispersed around the world, that's got fault tolerance if one of them goes down, to using a cache distribution network, so our content distribution network with caching servers, very, very easily, right? And that's one of the things that Platform as a Service is designed to do, is to say that if you write your app in this very specific way, you can get all these capabilities for very cheap. But the downside of that is that also implies that you're actually having to recreate applications in a way that fits that framework. And so because of that, there's also a very large and likely very permanent sort of market for this idea of infrastructure as a service. And that's the idea of, again, being able to get the base infrastructure, the ability to run virtual machines and operating systems delivered on demand through a cloud. That could be a cloud that runs in your environment or, again, like what we have with Windows Azure and the VM roles today. And then finally, if we think about all that in the context of how you could deploy it, there's really these three different concepts. And I guess going from least closed to most closed, I guess the least closed one would be the idea of a public cloud. That's something that literally your data and your applications could be sitting in a rack next to some customer that you've never met and that you'll never talk to and never have any idea about. That's kind of your classic Amazon Web Services or Windows Azure or even just traditional hosting sort of model. The private cloud is kind of the other end of that spectrum, in which you would say, I'm going to build something, maybe it runs in my own data center, it's on my own physical hardware, it's running only my own applications, and it's completely enclosed within my own walls. Private cloud is kind of the complete opposite of that. Still trying to give you all that elasticity and measured service and resource pooling and so forth, just in very different sort of delivery fashions. Kind of in between there is the idea of the community cloud. Community cloud is something that we've seen a lot of interest in, specifically in the governmental space as of late, where if you're a customer that has requirements around regulatory compliance or data locality or governance, again, very common in the government space, community clouds give you some of the advantages of a public cloud in the sense that you don't directly manage the hardware and the software. You're also able to have a larger pool of resources to take advantage of, but you also have greater levels of guarantee about where that data is, how it's being managed, and who else is a tenant in that environment. So if you saw recently our announcement about Office 365 for government, that's a good example of that, where we're saying we're going to run this Office 365 service, but it's going to be exclusively for the use of government customers. So if you have requirements that, you know, it's only U.S. citizens that administer it, and, you know, it falls under ITAR and other sorts of regulatory demands, we can guarantee that and say that the only tenants that will be in there will be other tenants that have those same requirements. And then finally, I think the thing that's most interesting long-term, because I think that the long-term answer is really not an or, but an and, is the idea of the private cloud, or the hybrid cloud, rather, which is to say that for most organizations, at least any organization of any sort of significant complexity, it's not going to be choosing one of those models and just using that completely and not using any of the others at all. Instead, it's going to be a matter of picking the right pieces and parts for what you want to do and how do you want to deliver a given service. So for example, you know, if you're a company that wants to be able to take advantage of software as a service that's delivered from the public cloud and you're using Office 365, well, at the same time, maybe you have some line of business applications that, you know, are absolutely mission critical for you and you feel like you need to own the entire experience for those end-to-end, you're running that in a private cloud. You may also have some other services that you pool in a community cloud. And so the idea of hybrid is really saying it's about taking a mix and match and choosing what makes the most sense for you to use when. Any questions about that? So again, the traditional IT pattern there was one that resulted in high cost, because if you look on the business, so to speak, on the left and IT on the right, you know, the business would start by making the request, IT would receive it, it would be provisioned. Typically, it would be provisioned in a very segmented, siloed sort of fashion, you know, so the server that was to run HR application was only running HR application. IT would manage it. They'd have to do maintenance to it. And because you couldn't predict the demand, it was almost always a situation where people were over-provisioning. You know, if I needed to have a server that was capable of running, servicing 3,000 users, and occasionally I might have 5,000 users, well, you had to buy a server that was capable of hosting 6,000 users to manage not only the peak, but whatever expected growth you had there. So there's a lot of waste, basically, that was created there, and waste typically means increased cost. So through whatever these cloud paradigms that you're trying to look for and combine to get that hybrid cloud, the idea is to drive down those costs through leveraging those attributes, those essential characteristics of the cloud. So again, it starts off with self-service. You don't have to talk to somebody to get that cloud. Once you make that selection, it's automatically provisioned for you. It's provisioned against a bank of pooled resources. The deployment is automated. The management is automated. The management is automated to the point that you don't actually, as an end user of the business, you don't even have to worry about when my machine is going down for maintenance, right? Because if it's done right, when maintenance occurs, it should be something that's seamless to me because I've got multiple fault-tolerant nodes. I can take down a given node, patch it, bring it back up, take down the second node, et cetera. Quota-based allocation is the idea there, again, saying we're not going to provide overcapacity. We're going to provide you a more elastic service where if you need, you know, a base load of 3,000 users all the time and a seasonal spike at the end of the year or at the holiday season to accommodate 10,000 users, then you just you provision that capacity on demand. Either let the system do it or you can proactively configure the system to do it. But the net result of all that is to optimize the resource consumption and thus to be able to drive down the cost. So one of the other things that people often get wrapped up about is the idea of virtualization and private cloud. There's a lot of people out there that had bought into a lot of virtualization over the past 10 years, and virtualization is fantastic. I mean, it is truly a cornerstone of being able to deliver on this vision. But virtualization in and of itself is not a private cloud, and one of the things that I've seen a lot of recently is people have even a highly virtualized environment kind of just renaming that to a private cloud environment. And there are some real differences that are important to understand between what is just a virtualized environment and what is truly a private cloud. And again, they tie back to those characteristics we talked about earlier. So virtualization, again, it provides the foundation, right? That's about the hardware, the fact that you're using some sort of shared storage and, you know, very high-speed network interconnects and the virtualization layer, what hypervisor you're using. But there's a lot more that goes into actually making a true private cloud. Those are those fabric management layers. That's the automation. That's, what are you able to do with PowerShell and WMI and WSMAN and so forth. The management layer, that's what System Center is able to do to tie those pieces together, and orchestration to tie together those disparate management systems so that, again, it's not about the individual pieces of technology, but kind of the sum of the whole. What do you get from all of the different, or the sum of the parts, what do you get from all of those put together? And then, again, probably the most important part that oftentimes customers' existing virtualized environments don't have is that self-service experience. You know, it's one thing to be able to, to allow people to request a virtual machine when they need it. It's an entirely different level of complexity and capability, though, to have a true self-service experience where if I want to have a virtual machine, I simply log on to a portal. Depending on who I am, what role I have in the organization, what business unit I'm part of, I get a very specific and tuned view of what I have access to. You know, if I'm part of the research and development network or division, perhaps I get a larger capacity that's assigned to me to be able to request virtual machines against, as opposed to if I were in finance or HR. Maybe if I'm part of a particular group that's got higher security requirements, like for example, if I work in healthcare and I'm a healthcare unit business IT group, excuse me, I'm a healthcare business unit user of this service, when I make that request, maybe the system is smart enough to be able to say this person is dealing with personally identifiable information or health-related information, and thus their data must be stored on a private cloud that's internal to my network and not shared. Yes? Yeah, so the question is, what's the difference between orchestration and automation, basically? Yeah, by Microsoft's design. So we define automation as essentially kind of being the lowest level of automation capability. So like that's the most detailed, implementation level configuration capability. So for example, we would say automation is about things like PowerShell and WSMAN and WMI, for example. Like what can you do at the base level of the operating system to get variables and to set variables, right? Management is how do you have an additional layer of abstraction on top of that so that you have a management tool that can say across many different systems, how can I get and set that information? You know, if I want to have a consistent configuration for, you know, the way that my hypervisor works or whatever, I can push that out. And then orchestration is about saying, if I have all these different management tools like that have kind of a different view into different things, like I have Configuration Manager to talk about, you know, from a product standpoint, and I have System Center Configuration Manager that deploys applications. I have Operations Manager that, you know, monitors system health and so forth. I have Virtual Machine Manager that monitors hypervisors and deploys virtual machines. Orchestration, what we have with System Center Orchestrator, is about tying all those together so that you can have a scenario in which when somebody requests a new virtual machine, that virtual machine is, that request is coming through and saying, not only do I just want a VM, but I want a VM that's configured as my developer environment. And so that orchestration engine calls VMM and says, okay, deploy this new Windows Server virtual machine, give it this much memory, this much, you know, CPU, et cetera. It calls SCCM and it says, okay, this is a dev server, so deploy SQL Server to it, deploy Visual Studio to it, et cetera. It installs whatever management packs may be required to monitor that workload that the developer is building. So orchestration is basically about saying, taking all those management tools that sit side by side that have all these, you know, all these different pieces of visibility and capability, how do you tie those together in a way that's more of a end-to-end solution and less so about just like managing that particular slice? Yeah, I mean, it's a workflow-based approach. So System Center Orchestrator, and there's a lot of, you know, I'm happy to answer a question about it, but there's a lot more technical detail that you can, you know, see a tech ed about this. But basically, Orchestrator is a way in which you have a kind of a graphical tool bench, almost like a Visio, and you can drag and drop an object and say, I want to run a script on this server, and the output of this script is going to, you know, based on the logic, you know, based on either it being positive or negative or within this range or whatever, I'm going to call this other script. And depending on what happens with that, I'm going to call this, you know, this deployment package out of CCM or this management package out of VMM or whatever. So again, orchestration is kind of like the meta manager. It manages SCOM and VMM and CCM, as well as many, many third-party products. You know, things that essentially, as long as you have a Telnet interface or an SSH interface to it, you can pretty much manage it with Orchestrator. Good question, though. Any others? Okay. So based on that, let's talk a little bit about our data center services IP, which, again, is kind of the Microsoft services set of intellectual property that we have for running private clouds and hybrid clouds and building those out. And, you know, why is it useful to you in the first place? Why should you care about it? And then what's kind of the value that you get out of it? So there's really three main reasons that we talk about having a service offering. The first one is about reducing risk. You know, anytime you start talking about doing a complex project, there's an inherently high level of risk that goes along with that complexity, right? If you're talking about building out a private cloud or a hybrid cloud in which you want to be able to run hundreds or thousands of virtual machines, they may run, you know, any number of different line of business applications for your organization. You know, you don't want to do that in a way that you know, maybe hasn't been fully tested or that is not, you know, utilizing necessarily all the best practices that are out there. And you don't want to have to recreate, you know, the sort of learning experiences that other customers out there have had. So, you know, to my quip earlier about learning from everybody else's mistakes, that's really what we mean when we talk about reducing risk. I mean, there's this huge body of knowledge that's basically comprised of the hundreds and thousands of projects that we've done in this space over the years that we're able to bring to bear in these projects because we have kind of this one mainstream set of IP, again, called data center services, and that as we go through each one of our projects, we reuse that. If there's gaps in it or problems or things that we identify, we reverse integrate those changes back upstream. And so as a customer, you always know that you're getting kind of the latest body of knowledge, again, the whole sum of all of our experiences. Was there a question? Ongoing success is really not about just how do you do the design and the deployment, but really over the long term, how do you optimize the usage of that? How do you drive down your cost? How do you run it in the most efficient manner? You know, Microsoft, and not just from the services standpoint, what we do in consulting, but really as a company overall, we actually have a pretty strong competency in data centers. You know, if you think about what we operate today for Bing and Office 365 and Azure and Xbox Live and so forth, all the way back to what we were doing, you know, 10, 15 years ago with Hotmail, we've been doing this for a very long time, and we've learned a lot of things ourselves during the course of that time. And many of the people that have worked on that running Microsoft's own environment work in services as well and, you know, have contributed to this IP. So one of the things we talk about with ongoing success is that we've got a lot of those experiences about not just the build and the design, but actually the operation. So you know about ITIL and our Microsoft Operations Framework, which is kind of a Microsoft-specific focus of ITIL. But basically, how do you take all those operational best practices for doing change management and incident management and deploying new capacity and so forth, and how do you really operationalize those inside of your business? And that's what we really refer to about ongoing success there. So all those best practices and operational guidance that's out there. And then, again, proven results. I mean, this stuff has been not just thought up and written about in a white paper, but actually delivered now with hundreds and thousands of customers in many different cases. So not only is it something that we've run through lots of just technical tests with, but we've deployed this with customers from virtually every sort of industry or line of business across virtually every country in the world. So been a lot of cultural and market-specific sort of findings and learnings that have gone into that. Again, that when you come to a project with us, we bring all that. That's just part of it. There's no additional cost. There's no additional intellectual property license that you're getting. That's just all the sort of things that we bring anytime we work with customers. So what is Microsoft Services? Again, it's pretty straightforward mission statement. It's really about helping customers maximize the value of Microsoft to them. You as a customer have invested in various products and technologies that we build. Services is all about how do you maximize the return on that investment. So we're not here as some sort of body shop. If you want us to outsource, if you want to outsource your data center to us, or you want us to send in 500 consultants to manage your back end, business process outsourcing, that's not what we do. We're a relatively small organization, and our focus is purely and exclusively on helping customers get more out of their investments on the Microsoft platform. And then kind of as a corollary to that is how do we help our partners? And partners have always been a key part of Microsoft's business and the way that we help our customers. How do we help our partners do that better as well? So from a Microsoft Services standpoint, we typically are engaged mostly in kind of tier one sort of customers, the customers that are very large, Fortune 500, governments, organizations, so forth like that. There's a huge space out there in the small and mid-market organization that frankly, we're just not scaled up to be able to staff, and that's where our partners really excel. They have better intelligence about that market, have typically much longer-term relationships with those customers, and so we want to make sure that the knowledge that we have here and that we develop over time is not just for us, but also share with that partner community and enables everybody to take advantage of that success. So again, that's what our focus is. It's not on being a body shop. So I found this despair poster years ago. I still think it's a great summary of what's different about our approach to consulting. I don't know if you guys have ever gone to like dentist office and they always have the cheesy posters of like an eagle flying over a mountain, and talks about enlightenment or whatever. This is what I think is really, really apt. Consulting, if you're not part of the solution, there's good money to be made in prolonging the problem. Which is something, unfortunately, that a lot of people have experienced firsthand, right? You have some problem, you hire somebody to fix it, and the solution to fixing it is always spend more money and hire more people, and the problem never seems to go away. It just has more people working on it. And again, I mean, that's not, all jokes aside, that's really just not our model. We're not there to bring in hundreds of people on a project. In fact, over the many years I've been at Microsoft, it's rare that you have more than a very small team of people working on even very, very large projects and almost always in conjunction with one of our partners in doing so. So what is data center services? What is this set of IP that I've been talking about? And more importantly, like, why do you care about it? Why is this something that's valuable to you? So there's four basic pillars that we talk about going into data center services. The first one is the idea of package services. So that is literally a set of scripts and tools and orchestrator runbooks and PowerShell automation and all the other, like, literally bits and bytes, technology stuff that goes into allowing you to animate a private cloud from the bare metal all the way up through service delivery. Instead of this taking you weeks or sometimes months to do, it's something that we can do in the space of just a few days. So, it's a very, I think, one of the best real-world examples of this is, a lot of times when we go to a customer, if we're going to deploy a private cloud for a customer, once the hardware has been decided upon and we've gone through some initial envisioning to understand, what the end state should look like, how they want things to be designed, what sort of capabilities are important to them, Once those base decisions have been made, we can typically go in there and deploy a private cloud capable of running 4,000 virtual machines in less than a week's time. So it's not something that again, is you're looking at some project that's months long and involves hundreds of consultants or whatever. Because we've got all this IP that's already been created for doing this in a highly automated, highly repeatable fashion, and we bring that as part of all of our projects, we're able to really drive down the cost of that. So packaged services, again, is that idea or that set of knowledge about how do you do that hydration, how do you do the automated installation of things and be able to rapidly provision all these services and capabilities. One neat example of that is we can literally go and install a Windows server on one server in a cluster through a hydration process. In other words, kind of a hands-off install, like a completely zero-touch sort of install process. And then from that, it boots up and animates all the other nodes that are part of that cluster. It installs VMM on them. It adds them to the management surface for you. It configures a self-service portal. We can even do application-level installations for running specific workloads, for example, SharePoint and SQL Server based on that. So again, the idea there, drive down costs by automation and repeatability. The deployment framework is kind of the first step in that process, though. And deployment framework is not talking about technology and tools or scripts, but really about how do you go through making the decisions about how do you want this private cloud to look and operate and integrate with what you already have. So the deployment framework is really a set of what we refer to as decision leading workshops that take place at the beginning of one of these projects where, if a customer says that I want a private cloud or I want to be able to kind of upgrade my data center, so to speak, and get advantages of these cloud attributes that we've been talking about today, the deployment framework and these decision leading workshops is about saying, okay, given that, let's figure out what are the scenarios that are most important to you. Maybe the things that are most important to you are really focused around the idea of self-service. Alternatively, maybe you have no plans to offer self-service to your business units and all you care about is driving down cost and repeatability. Or maybe it's something completely different. So the decision leading workshops help us identify what are the things that are most important to key in on the design and to really refine and enhance the design to highlight those areas. And then secondly is, no place that we go into is a complete green field. I mean, every one of you out there has some existing data center today. You've got some existing Active Directory, some existing groups and hierarchy for managing that and so forth. So how do you integrate this new capability with what you've already got? Right? Because you never want to hear an answer that starts off with, we're going to have to start from scratch or, this is a brand new fresh install and, you're going to have to rebuild and recreate everything that you've already done. This only is really, really viable for you as a customer if this can integrate with what you've already got and do so in a way that is as least disruptive as possible. So part of that deployment framework is that set of decision-leading workshops in which we identify, what does your AD structure look like? How do you do management today? How do you deployment today? And all these attributes become inputs into our design so that we literally have a set of tools where as those workshops complete and we get information on, how things are configured in your current environment, that directly feeds into what that design will look like. How do we configure Active Directory to manage that fabric with the Active Directory you already have? Is it standalone and configured via a trust, or is it simply integrated with what you already have? What's the level of compartmentalization that you need between those environments? So that deployment framework, the idea there, again, is not technology, but about how do you have a rigorous, well-defined process and methodology for making decisions about the design, again, to lead to higher quality, more predictable results. Service delivery best practices is about, again, leveraging all the things that Microsoft has learned over the years operating our own data centers and doing data center consulting with other customers. Not so much about design, the technology deployment, but how do you take change management best practices and really integrate them into the way that you operate this environment? One of the things that is a risk when you deploy a private cloud or some sort of hybrid cloud design is, you go from having fault domains, to use kind of the common parlance, but basically like units of failure from being a given server, right? If somebody makes a mistake in a kind of a legacy environment, they mess up a configuration of something in a legacy environment, chances are you're limited to a single application maybe or a single server that's running multiple VMs or something. But if you have a private cloud where all these things are integrated, where everything is orchestrated and automated very highly, then you have a scenario in which you can very easily make a mistake that can truly take down the entire organization, right? If you deploy some update that you don't want to have out there, or for example, you mess something up in a runbook, and instead of provisioning a new virtual machine, you tell some command to remove all virtual machines or whatever, the changes that you make in a highly automated environment happen much more quickly and almost by definition are much wider in scope than they historically have been. So to do that safely and to really take advantage of that, you also have to have similarly mature operational management practices. So part of what we do is the team that works with you for Microsoft Services is not just technology guys, but there's also going to be some people whose entire skill set is grounded in ITIL and operational consulting and figuring out how to really optimize the way that you manage it from a people and process standpoint rather than any sort of technology implications. And then finally, extensible platform, whatever we build here is built on top of supported APIs in the product. We're not out there recreating functionality that already exists in the product. We're not trying to do anything that's going to put you on an unsupported path or anything like that. But at the same time, we want to create a platform that's easy for you to build upon yourselves later on. So one of the great things about the Microsoft automation platform, the Microsoft kind of private cloud platform, is because we're all based on PowerShell, and PowerShell is such a powerful and, frankly, just really easy and administrator-friendly environment, it's very easy for you, after we finish a project, to go in there and say, if I want to modify the way some of these runbooks work or enhance things to take advantage of some new, merge or acquisition or whatever that we've done, everything is documented. It's fully out there. I mean, the source, so to speak, not truly like compile code, but the source of those PowerShell scripts is very readable and well-documented and extensible and easy for you to add on to later. Same thing from an orchestrator standpoint. The idea here is not to lock you into having to come to us for everything, but to really empower you to be able to do it on your own going forward. So to go back to one of the slides that we looked at earlier, again, virtualization is the foundation. And what data center services is about is all those other layers on top of that that truly deliver the private cloud, the automation, the management, the orchestration, and the self-service portal. So let's put it all together. If there's one slide that you remember from today, this is probably the best one to remember because I think it ties together, maybe the NIST one would be good too, but this one ties together all the products and technologies. It really, I think, describes very well how everything fits together and takes you from these conceptual ideas to something to say, I really understand what goes into each level. So again, the base layer is always the hardware, right? So we've got a Microsoft Private Cloud Fast Track Reference Architecture. How many of you guys have ever heard of Fast Track before? A few of you? Okay. So if you go to Microsoft.com/private cloud, you can read about it. But essentially, all the major server OEMs have a Private Cloud Fast Track Reference Architecture. And that reference architecture is not just, here's a recommended set of storage, networking, compute stuff to buy based on the amount of capacity you need, but it's actually a fully validated SKU. So it's not, you don't just submit and say, this is what, this is the hardware SKU that we'd recommend as an OEM, but actually that OEM SKU is brought into our Enterprise Engineering Center at Redmond. We run load and peak simulation tests against it. We really truly validate the entire thing end to end so that you know what you're getting is fully ready to run private cloud. All the firmware works, all the storage and network interconnects are there and at enough capacity to run things the way that you want, and that the entire solution end to end is supportable and is going to give you the sort of results that you want. So the base is always the hardware, of course. On top of that is a virtualization layer. In the Microsoft world, of course, that's Hyper-V, which is a part of Windows Server. So, today the currently released product is Server 2008 R2. In the near future, it'll be Server 2012. So you think of that, obviously, as Hyper-V. And this is kind of answering some of the question that was earlier. The automation layer is, again, the parts where we're really talking about what are those low-level granular interfaces that allow you to do centralized configuration and automation of tasks. And that's PowerShell, it's WMI, it's WSMan. These are all the things that you would think of if you had a standalone server and you wanted to automate something there. This is something that you know is a common denominator. This works across all your servers and is kind of the lowest level of configuration capability. On top of that, the management layer is that set of functionality that is embodied typically in your system center tools, which say, that low-level capability for doing automation and management, if I abstract the base computer that I'm operating against that and say, now instead of doing this on a one-to-one basis, I can do it on a very large, one-to-many. I can manage not just one server, but I can manage 1,000 servers at the same time. That's really what we're talking about when we're talking about management. That's what you get with OpsMan and ConfigurationMan and VMM and so forth. And above that is Orchestrator. Orchestrator is saying, given all those different pieces of management, they're still sort of siloed in what they do, right? Data Protection Manager is focused on obviously doing backup and protection of data. System Center Config Manager is focused on deploying new applications and new services. OpsMan is obviously looking at service health and monitoring and so forth. But if you pull all the pieces of data that those things have the ability to query and to monitor, as well as the things that they have the ability to change and to deploy, if you pull all that into one big pool and you provide an easy way to link them all together in a way that's really business-centric and not so much about having to write a bunch of automation code and actually write binaries or DLLs, but instead really have kind of a point-and-click experience in doing that, that's really what Orchestrator is there to provide. And then finally, what is the interface for somebody that's an administrator of this to be able to go in and make those changes? And that's really where Service Manager comes into play. So Service Manager, as you guys are probably aware, is a relatively new addition to the System Center suite. And Service Manager is an extensible platform to allow you to, you know, not just receive service requests, but have all the workflows associated with it, the results of those workflows, to report on them, and so forth. So it kind of is the human interface into Orchestrator, if you will, in the sense that if you want to request new capacity, you probably do that through Service Manager, and Service Manager would kick off jobs in Orchestrator, which would kick off various other functions in all those management layers, which would then be orchestrated executed in the automation layer, which would implement change at the virtualization layer. So you can see kind of the human operates from the top down, and the changes that impact the machine also flow from the top down. Any questions about that? So from a service offering standpoint, we offer three tiers or three levels, I guess you would say, of our data center services solution, from least complex to most capable. The least complex being the foundation offering there, and you can see the components that it utilizes. Basically, the foundation offering is just saying, you know, there's these inbox capabilities that we have with App Controller and OpsMan and VMM. Without extending them whatsoever, this is kind of just the best practices reference architecture, the reference design for deploying that. The advanced offering is where you really start seeing more of the value of tying things together. That's where you really leverage the entirety of the system suite, and you also have the hydration capability to take advantage of all the automation that we've done for deploying new systems and deploying new services within those systems. And then finally, the enterprise system is the one, or the enterprise offering, it's truly the end-to-end one. That's where you really have all the operational consulting that goes into that. You've also got the customized portal experience, which is above and beyond what you get in the product box, as well as all the other capabilities that you have lower down in the stack. You don't really have to worry about knowing what these are or anything like that. Really, what we try to do from a services standpoint is that when we talk to a customer where private cloud is an important thing for them, and we're going to talk to them about how to enable that, part of those decisions is understanding what their needs are, what they're looking to be able to do, how complex their scenario is, and then recommending the right level of this to them. But the thing I want to highlight on this slide is we've got offerings all the way from things that are very simple. I mean, the Private Cloud Foundation is something that you could typically deploy and have up and running in production in just a handful of days, to something like Private Cloud Enterprise, which typically has a lot more integration and configuration and provides a much more complete enterprise level solution that may take several months to deploy, for example. So again, it's kind of a continuum of different options, and depending on what you're looking for, we've got different sets of capability there. The key thing to understand, though, is it's all based on supported products, it's all based on supported interfaces, and it's all a common set of IP. We're not going to tell you to deploy things in one way if you're doing the foundation and tell you something totally different in an advanced layer. It's really more of a additive approach where you're building upon greater levels of complexity for more enterprise sorts of scenarios. So to touch on a few of those capabilities, remember probably the key message about DCS from a supportability standpoint is that we're really focused on automation, integration, and hydration. We're trying to make it easier and faster for you to deploy the stuff that already exists in the products. We're not innovating. We're not investing or creating brand new things. We're not building something that's not supportable. We're not deploying things in a way that requires access to some sort of secret API or undocumented script or whatever. I mean, the idea here is really just to make it easier and faster, again, to deploy what you've already got. So what are some of the scenarios that are enhanced there? I gave the example earlier of automated server deployment. Literally, you just start turning on servers, they boot from the network, they get the entire configuration pushed down to them through WDS and the other capabilities in the System Center suite. The automated virtualization configuration, automated patching is an interesting one there. That's one of the things that's available in System Center now, but historically had not been as complete or really fully there. Automated patching is about saying if I have an 8-node cluster that's running 500 virtual machines or something, and I want to deploy a security update or a service pack to that, automated patching was a set of PowerShell scripts and orchestrator automation where you as an administrator didn't have to worry about saying I wanted to patch node number one right now, so first I'm going to move all the virtual machines off of it, then I'm going to patch it, then I'm going to reboot it, then I'm going to make sure it's up to date, then I'm going to move the VMs back onto it, and I'm going to do the same process over and over again. Instead, this is literally done as an orchestrator runbook. You simply pass it a set of parameters. What are the servers you want to update, or what are the clusters really that you want to update? An orchestrator is smart enough to do all that for you. So that's an example of what you can get with, again, with this DCS intellectual property. So one of the other bullets I want to highlight on this fact is that we as Microsoft Services, we fully support the entire solution, which is from the hypervisor up, all the automation, the integration components. If you guys already have Premier support today, this is simply just an additional kind of add-on or additional service, I guess, that we can provide via Premier. So that, if you say all this automation is great, we love it, but we're trying to get to the mentality of IT being more of a facilitator or a broker and less about us managing and maintaining all the low-level systems, we want to pay our vendors to do that. We can absolutely do that for you as well. I mean, we can manage we can support and update all that, and through our partner, we can provide management and monitoring of that as well. So everything from something where we build it and we train you and turn it over to you and you run it completely on your own to a model in which we build it and design it, a partner runs it, and we provide support for it. So again, a complete continuum of how involved you'd like us to be. Yes?
So with self-service, is there anything in the offering for IT finding stale services? Somebody requested something, you got provisioned, it hasn't been used in 6 months?
Great question. So the question is there a way to go out there and find things that are essentially under capacity, basically, or underutilized, or maybe capacity that's been over-provisioned, it's not actually being utilized? So absolutely. In fact, that's one of the default things that we can do is to actually query that and say, let's say you've got 1,000 VMs in your environment. Out of those 1,000 VMs, there's 100 of them that have never been logged into. No one's ever touched them. And every 30 days, for example, you can get this report. In fact, one of the projects we did with a very large bank recently, this bank has around 4,000 developers globally. And they wanted to utilize a private cloud stack for their developers' dev and test environment. So, they're not actually running the customer-facing apps there, but I mean, it very much is mission critical. I mean, that's where they build and update everything. And they had almost exactly the problem that you described there, where, historically their developers would say, well, I'm building this new application. I need to have 10 VMs requested for it. So they go and request 10 VMs. They'd use two of them. And you just had these other 8 sitting out there soaking up compute cycles and so forth. And yeah, they were virtual, but I mean, they were still running and they were still a cost and a burden to maintain and just taking up electrons and spewing out carbon that nobody needed. So what we've done with them is basically build on top of this DCS solution and use Orchestrator to say that every 30 days we run a report and figure out how many VMs are out there that haven't been logged into within that 30-day period. And that because that, and you'll see this in a moment here, because when those VMs are provisioned, we can tie an individual person, an individual human being to who requested that VM in the first place, they'll get an automated email via service manager and says, hey, look, here's a list of VMs that you requested that you haven't logged into in 30 days. If you're not using them, don't worry about it. A week from now, we're going to delete them and reclaim them. You can always get new ones when you need to. If you are actually using them, just click this link here to acknowledge that, and we'll leave you alone for another month. And those are all tunable parameters, right? You may want it to be a much longer period or maybe shorter or whatever, but the key thing is that the knowledge about how to do that, reporting and automation and kind of self-service, not just provisioning, but self-service, life cycling, I guess, if you will, that's all built into the solution, something that you don't have to worry about recreating on your own. Good question. So let's look a little bit. We're not going to go through a bunch of screenshots. So I promise I won't bore you too much with this. But I think it's useful if we go through and look at some idea of what the actual user experiences look like. So we'll go through these quickly. And this is really we're going to show you first the view of what an administrator will see, and then secondly what an end user will see. So let me define two terms now that you'll see throughout the screenshots. We'll probably talk about a little bit. But the idea of a resource pool. A resource pool is the set of resources that are required to deliver some unit of capacity. And you know, it sounds really vague, and it is very vague, but basically the idea is it's a logical grouping of storage, network, and compute that allows you to deliver a service. So I often equate a resource pool to somebody as thinking about this as like a fully configured rack of servers with, you know, some sort of direct attached storage or SAN or whatever, you know, a top of the rack switch and so forth. But basically that resource pool, you can think of that as a fully configured rack. You know, that resource pool or that rack may be capable of running, let's say, 1,000 virtual machines, for example. So there's a set of servers, a set of storage, there's a set of networking that goes into that. That resource pool can be further combined to make larger units of capacity that we refer to as the fabric, right? And the fabric is saying not just a single resource pool, but multiple resource pools, potentially spread across multiple data centers. So if you're a large, very complex organization, you may have, and likely do have, more than one data center globally. But if you'd like to, you can manage that entire set of data centers as a single fabric. And you can just say that we're going to place some resources in different parts of that fabric to provide lower latency or, you know, quicker access to end users that are in that location. But basically, this, we're using a common management platform across everything globally. So let's take a look at what this looks like from an administrator standpoint. So this is a screen snip of the actual portal that somebody that's an admin would go into. In that portal, you can see that they'd be able to look at a very high level. They get a view of, for a given tenant, show me all the resources that given tenant is using today. And again, these are tunable parameters. You know, if you want to have different things that you see as opposed to what the defaults are, we can absolutely change them and modify them as you want. The costs are, of course, adjustable. But the idea here is that simply by going through a browser, you can get a very easy heads-up view of, for a given tenant, and in your case, the tenant might be the HR department or the U.S. subsidiary or, you know, the Research Triangle Park office or whatever. However you wanted to define different tenants in the environment, you can define as views in this. So whatever makes sense for your organization, the solution is adaptable to meet that. And it's a similar thing if you think about the way that Active Directory is adaptable. We don't require that you design your domain hierarchy in a particular way, right? When you deploy your domain controller, if you want to have your sites segmented out in a particular way, or you want to define your groups, for example, and your OU structure by business unit, or if you want to define it by geography, or if you want to define it by, you know, physical location of an office, or whatever you want to do, you're flexible in that. And the same thing applies here. So you're not tied to this given model. Obviously, the quotas and so forth you set are also adjustable as well. If you drill into a given tenant, though, so kind of getting to the next level of detail beyond that, you can see now for a given tenant, what are the different, you see there the middle section is the roles. Those are definitions that you create to say that these are logical groupings of applications or services that are consumed or utilized by that particular tenant. So in this case, there's an app tier, there's a SQL backend, there's a web front end. Other tenants might have things like, you know, a big data role. They may have a SharePoint role. They may have some other sort of roles that are there. But roles are basically ways for you to group and thus define characteristics of that. So you might say that the web tier has greater levels of CPU and memory and much lower levels of disks assigned to it in its VM template. Whereas the SQL role might have both a large amount of memory and disk, as well a large amount of memory and CPU, as well as a large amount of disk there. So again, these are all basically logical constructs which you can tune and which you can configure in a way that makes sense to your organization, the way that you prefer to do management in your environment. So this is a more of a physical view. So again, we're still looking through the lens of an IT administrator, somebody that's managing the system. So we're getting out of the idea of what are the tenants, what are the business units, but now looking at it from more of an administrator standpoint, you can see here, now if I drill down, instead of seeing just kind of a high-level view of, you know, my consumption based on virtual CPUs and memory at a per quota role basis, I can now see that down to the level of the individual virtual machines. So if I go to my next level of detail here, I can see that for this given role, the SQL backend role, it's comprised of two virtual machines. This is their CPU makeup. This is the amount of memory they have. If I want to manage it, I can click on a link, and we'll see what that looks like in a minute. If I want to deprovision it and reclaim that capacity, I can do all this directly through the browser. I'm not having to add any special tool for this. And I can expose as much or as little of this to my users as I'd like to. You know, for example, a lot of customers have some sort of IT liaison in a business unit. That kind of is the conduit for IT functions into central IT. Perhaps that person is a person that manages this, or perhaps you allow direct end users to do it. Again, the choice is completely yours, and we're leveraging all your existing investments in Active Directory and so forth to do that group management, provisioning, and define roles and so forth. So when you click on that option to manage, this is where you can get a much more drilled down, detailed view. So these are, again, these are all things that are surfaced all the way from the virtual machine up to the portal. So no one had to install any tools in their computer to do this. This, again, is accessible from a broad network connection. So any sort of internet, if you want to expose it over the web, you can get access to this. So you can go and see a snapshot of overall utilization and resource consumption. You can get a direct remote desktop connection to it. Up at the top, we bubble up all the alerts through the portal. We provide all the detailed system properties, you know, things that typically people have had to go into the actual remote desktop interface to be able to get, like, what's the IP address, what's the, you know, what's the configuration for the Active Directory SID and so forth. We have a list of software updates, and you can also do performance monitoring, and even more so than just performance monitoring, you can provide a self-service way for people to add other performance monitor counters. So even if somebody is not, you know, familiar with utilizing PerfMon, or they don't have access to install and utilize PerfMon within the VM, you can provide just a regular end user with the ability to say, look, I want to monitor CPU utilization, and I want to be able to do that independent of IT. Like, I want to get my own reports about, you know, how my service is operating. One of the examples where we saw this was a large retailer that we worked with where some of the business units wanted to manage and monitor web front-end utilization during the holiday season. And this was a really, what they found to be a really empowering thing to them, because historically the people that were doing retail marketing didn't really have a good idea of why the website might be running slow or why things weren't performing the way they wanted to. This allowed us to make it a very real and visible thing to say, look, here's this chart. You know, and you can see this chart is showing you how much capacity you've got. And, you know, if we're below that 100% line, then we have additional capacity. If not, we can add additional capacity to get it. So it really gave a much greater level of comfort to people that were not IT users, but that still wanted to have some level of insight into the service. Virtual machine provisioning. So this is what it would look like for somebody that's actually making the request to use the service. Notice here, you know, you as the IT organization, you choose all the attributes that they see here. For example, you set what domains they can add it to, where the locations are available to, what the names of the clouds are, what their quotas are, what the VM templates are. And these are all things that we build for you during the course of that project. Remember I talked about those decision leading workshops where we define how you want this to look. Once we know how this is going to look, those attributes flow directly into the way that this portal behaves and the sort of things that people can request. For example, you know, some customers say that I just want a very small number of templates, right? I want to have things very standardized, but very coarse granularity in that. Other customers say I want to be very granular, have very, very specific templates, but have a much larger number of them. And the choice, again, is yours. It's a continuum of options that you've got there. So in this case, you know, the user is saying, I want to have a small server. Small is defined as something with just a gig of memory. And my quota right now, I've got, if you look under available quota, I've got about 6 gigs of memory quota available. So right now, I could request a small VM with 1 gig of memory. Alternatively, if I change my choice to being a large VM that requires 8 gigs of memory, I don't have the ability to submit that request because I don't have enough quota to fulfill it. So this is just a really basic example, but it kind of shows you the self-service experience that people would get. Similar to, you know, if you're going to sign up for, you know, for Xbox Live or a Gmail account or a Hotmail account or whatever it is it might be, that wizard that you walk through, if you don't complete the information properly, or if you sign up for a credit card and you don't provide your SSN or something, just that web-based experience that people are familiar with there, with it saying, okay, look, there's this red line here, you need to put in your SSN to complete this transaction, it's the same experience that they get through the portal. So again, the idea is to really help adoption by familiarization and utilizing a common set of experiences that people are already used to. Again, if you wish to enable it. Not everybody necessarily wants to do the virtual machine self-service. So let's skip through a few since we're running a little bit short on time here. But the highlight of these slides is basically just to show that we've integrated this solution fully with System Center Service Manager. So again, we're not building something brand new. We're simply leveraging what's already there. This is an example of that workflow that I talked about earlier for doing virtual machine patching. And really, this just shows you the degree of complexity and automation that you're able to do with the solution. So you can take a process that requires all these different steps, all these different branching conditions. So, you know, was it successful? Was it not successful? Has the move finished? Is it not finished? Et cetera. All of this complex sort of workflow, encapsulate that into a single orchestrator runbook and thus be callable on demand. Literally, you can say, when an event occurs, I want this to happen and kick off this entire orchestrated series of events that touch VMM and Orchestrator and Windows Server clustering and PowerShell across all of them. So taking a whole tremendous amount of things that were complex to do or required a lot of human interaction in the past and distilling them now down into something that is, again, a repeatable, highly automated action that you can literally now call on demand. You can call it through a browser if you want to enable that through the portal. So talk a little bit about hydration. I think I've touched on some overview of that already, but this is a good little kind of joke about what's the purpose of hydration. You know, think about how many hours of your life you've already spent looking at stuff like this. I want to install SharePoint, so the first thing I do is I go into Windows Server and I install some prerequisites, and then I have to install updates. And then I install SQL Server, and then I have to install updates. And I install SharePoint, and I have to install updates. And at the end of all that, I have to configure the entire thing, right? So what that means is that, you know, if you want to install a typical SharePoint installation within an enterprise, it may be a full day's process to do that. Because we've got so much experience doing that and so much experience automating that process, we can take that from being something that's very manually intensive, where you've got some worksheet or, you know, some set of screenshots that you're paying some human being to go through and click buttons on, and have the entire thing fully automated. And again, you don't have to worry about building that. We're not building a custom one for you. You're not going to have to pay some hourly rate for us to create that every single time with you. You're just able to leverage all the intellectual property that we've done in years past, having done this with many other customers already. And again, we're not using any kind of black magic. This is the existing supportable automation interfaces that are already in the product. So this is a solution that is supportable and something that you can be safe and confident in your usage of and not worry about being down some path where, you know, you have to have some expensive services engagement to continue using this project. What we build, we want to be, have a long life cycle in which you can automate it and run it completely on your own in the future. So just a few screenshots of what the hydration wizard looks like. So you'll basically, you know, you'll point it at where the source files are. You'll point it at a basic text configuration file that we give to you. You'll choose what you want to deploy, choose what sort of options you want in that, and then the entire solution is automatically hydrated for you. And hydration is basically, you know, it's kind of the notion of taking a, you know, let's say some food or whatever that an astronaut was going to use and dehydrating it, you know, taking out all the things and shrinking it down into something more, easier to transport. The same idea with this. You know, we take all the complexity down, we shrink it into a virtual machine, and then when that virtual machine is animated, we just kind of feed in, instead of water, we're feeding in configuration data to it. It pulls all that data in and builds itself out in the way that you want it. So how do we get there, you know, from where you're at right now? As I mentioned earlier, you know, you rarely are going to encounter any sort of green fields in this space. I mean, everybody's got some sort of virtualization already. So a core part of what we want to do is to make it easy and efficient for you to migrate from that to what we've been talking about today. So we've got an offering that we call Switch to Hyper-V that leverages a solution accelerator called the Virtual Machine Migration Toolkit, which is a free download you can get from Microsoft.com. And it basically integrates that with a set of tools from Veeam, who's one of our partners. It also utilizes a lot of orchestration and automation capabilities that we've got built into System Center already and additional scripting that we've done on top of that. And then also optionally allows you to leverage our global delivery team, so our offshore resources. If you want to have some human beings to interact with the solution, to queue up virtual machines, to do maybe some tasks that couldn't be fully automated, for example, if you had a really complex set of, you know, virtual disk configurations or something that for whatever reason couldn't be fully migrated in a completely autonomous manner. So there, it's kind of the full spectrum of things. It's the intellectual property for doing it. It's a set of capabilities that are built into the product, and it's also we can provide you, if you'd like to have them, with some low-cost economic resources to be able to drive that process. So how does it actually work? The idea is at no point will you ever be in a situation where if there's a failure that you're not able just to go back to what you already had. So it's a very safe process. It's a very low risk process. So we go out there using either the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit or Veeam Reporter and discover what you've already got. We utilize the Veeam tool to back up your existing environment, your existing VMware environment. We essentially take a clone of that, and then we do the further operations on that clone. So if there is a failure, if there is something unforeseen that happens, you've never lost the original, right? You can always just go back to what you already had before the process started. Once that clone has been made, then we go through a conversion process and read it out of the VMware format. We remove all the VMware tools. We install the Hyper-V tools. And then at that point, you have a fully functional Hyper-V environment. So one of the things that this is a really neat solution for is, you know, with Virtual Machine Manager, we can manage not only Hyper-V, but also Xen and ESX. And so for some customers, you know, they're looking at that and saying, we've already got this great cross-platform management capability, but we'd like to draw down our utilization on the ESX side and, you know, and save some licensing costs and so forth. And this is a way that we can integrate this tool set directly into your data center so that you can just, as you want to, on demand, migrate those virtual machines from one environment to the other. You can do it as a big bang approach and do them all at once, or you can alternatively do it, you know, as you decommission servers or hardware gets to end of life. Again, the choice is really yours. So it's a very self-service sort of experience. Obviously, end users aren't going to be doing this, but self-service in the sense that people that are just kind of operator-level skill sets within the data center. Once that report is run, you'll get this list of all the VMs that are available. You know, you can migrate CentOS and Red Hat, as well as Windows servers, of course. You select the ones you want to migrate over. It kicks off a series of orchestrator workflows, and orchestrator is calling all those components we were talking about to do the migration. And then you basically go from the picture on the left being obviously what you saw with vSphere to the picture on the right, which is what you see with VMM, and essentially taking those virtual machines and their previous configuration, how much memory and disk, and what VLANs they were attached to, and obviously what software and configuration they had internally, and replicating that completely, bit for bit on the Hyper-V side. So again, the idea here is not just to make it possible for you to run and manage workloads on both sides, but for you to be able to very cost-effectively and repeatably migrate a workload off of that VMware environment and into the Hyper-V environment. So just one brief case study here as we wrap up. One of the customers that we did some work with fairly recently was the Royal Mail out of the UK. They obviously have similar sorts of constraints on their business as our Postal Service does. You know, they're trying to drive down their costs and increase their efficiency and so forth. And so they wanted to move to a model in which they had better flexibility and agility and lower cost and really take advantage of that entire private cloud mentality. They also were a customer that's it's an Office 365 customer, is looking to run more and more of their workloads in SharePoint on Office 365. They also had a partner, Computer Sciences Corporation, that's historically been involved in running their data centers. So what we did during the course of the project was go in there, help the partner understand what their current environment looks like, help the customer Royal Mail Group understand what their real priorities are and to prioritize that list and say, you know, it's all about the agility and cost reduction and so forth, really to tease out what are the major areas of focus for the product, and then to leverage all of this intellectual property that we've been talking about to really increase the velocity of that migration from their existing kind of physical and basically virtualized environment into more of a private cloud model, into something where they're able to take advantage of all this IP and knowledge, again, that we've been talking about today, and essentially build out that same set of capabilities in their own data center. And the neat thing in their environment is not only were they able to reduce risk and establish that ongoing pattern of success and get those proven results, but they were able to do so in conjunction with that partner, CSC, who had historically been working with them. So they still had that same level of familiarity. They were still working with that partner that really understood their business and that they've been aligned with for some time. And we, from a Microsoft Services standpoint, were there just to make sure that they, you know, both the partner and the customer had the right high-level set of knowledge and the deep experiences in doing this and the right high-level design to make it happen. So again, our goal there is not to send 500 people to a project and to do the entire thing ourselves, but really to make the customer more efficient and make it happen more quickly and to enable our partners to be successful with it. And again, I mentioned earlier that one of the interesting side angles to that is the fact that this private cloud is truly a hybrid cloud in their scenario, and that They're not only servicing workloads in-house in their own data center running on their own hardware, but actually having some of those workloads coexist with things in SharePoint Online. So they've got the ability to have some data sources that are running locally and be able to export that data and federate some access to that data with their SharePoint Online environment that's running in Office 365. So truly a model of a hybrid cloud that's able to take advantage of these capabilities that we've been talking about today. So just to summarize what our coverage was today, we talked earlier about what the private cloud is. We looked at that NIST definition as really being a great way to have a common set of vocabulary and to make sure that we're all talking about a very specific set of things and ideas rather than just some vendor's marketing spin. When we talk about private cloud and hybrid cloud and what that is. Data center services and the fact that DCS is really all about helping you as a customer get better results, cheaper, and just safer. By leveraging all the experiences and knowledge that we've gained over the years working with other customers and able to take advantage of all that reference IP. And also importantly that it's just built on existing products. We're not going out there and building some sort of custom one-off solution or something that's unsupportable or something that is some sort of thing that you need our access to special source code for or whatever to be able to design. We're just helping accelerate your time to value of those products and the capabilities that those products already have in box. Hydration and migration is being a way, again, to make it easier and faster to deploy and then easier and faster to move your stuff that you currently have into our environment. And then we talked about the case study that we had with Royal Mail. So at this point, we're pretty much out of time, but I'd be more than happy to stay afterwards and take any questions that anyone has. And if there's no questions at this point, I'll thank you for coming and hope you have a great rest of your Tech Ready or Tech Ed.